From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Both presidential campaigns are quietly assembling advisors who will form the foundation of a new White House. We're talking about men and women of what's called the transition team, people who make sure that in the weeks between Election Day and Inauguration Day, the new president has the tools and people he needs. Of course, neither side wants to seem overly confident before victory is clinched, but we've got two people here to explain the how and who of the presidential transition team. P.J. Crowley is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and Robert Trainum is the D.C. Bureau Chief for the Comcast Cable Network, CN8. Thank you both for joining us.
Hi, Farai.
A pleasure.
So, okay, both of you have worked in transition teams, P.J. with the Clinton administration, and Robert, you worked with George W. Bush's team in 2000. I'm going to start with you, P.J. Where do you think each campaign is in terms of preparing the team, but also revealing who's on it publicly, since we're just weeks away from Election Day?
Well, I think, first of all, both campaigns have literally hundreds of advisors across the various policy dimensions. And a cadre of those advisors could easily be the core of transition teams on both sides. I think we're kind of in a middle ground here. I understand that the campaigns, on the one hand, don't want to feel presumptuous. They can be accused of measuring the drapes for the White House, but by the same token, we have to understand that we're in a very dynamic new world here in the 21st century, and world events don't wait for the president to be inaugurated, get settled, assemble his team. So I think we should be getting to the point as a country where transition planning should become more a part of a campaign, and I don't think that either side should be reticent about saying that we are forming the cadre of people to be able to quickly transition from campaign mode to transition mode to governing mode, because when you look at the challenges that we face, the economy on the one hand, Iraq and Afghanistan on the other, of the various issues that have been debated as part of this campaign, there really will be a great sense of urgency for the new president to get off to a very rapid and decisive start. And that really starts with taking advantage of the time that's available between now and January 20th.
All right, Robert, I'm going to go to you in 1 second. But, PJ, you are working with John Podesta, and he worked in the Clinton campaign as well, now heads up the Center for American Progress, which is where you are. Do you expect that he will take a leadership position in an administration if Senator Obama is elected? And what's the purpose? Maybe you start with what's the purpose of your center?
Well, the Center for American Progress is a think tank. We've been in business for about 5 years. So we advance what we term as a progressive agenda across national security policy, economic policy, domestic policy, energy, and the environment. There has been some reporting that Mr. Podesta could be one of the transition leaders in an Obama administration. But I do think that the Center for American Progress, just like other think tanks in Washington, the Heritage Foundation, for example, on the right-hand side, think tanks have been part of this transition planning. Most of the organizations in Washington have done, some programs or produce some planning or documents that are outlining for whichever side wins the election. These are the challenges that you're going to have to face. This will be the kind of characteristic you might want, for example, in a new Secretary of Homeland Security, since that is, Homeland Security and the Director of National Intelligence, for example. These are two agencies going through their first ever full presidential transition, and so there is a lot of thought going on. Also,
let me
within
get
the
Robert
Bush administration,
in
to its credit, to the Bush administration has done a lot of thinking about transition planning, itself.
All right, Robert. Heritage Foundation came up. Heritage Foundation has played a large role in the past in certain transitions. But is there any think tank now that is really in the driver's seat in terms of a McCain transition team coming together? Is there, because many people have asked, what is Senator McCain's base of support? Is there any one group that you see a lot of folks coming into a transition team from?
Well, I wouldn't say there's one specific group per se. You mentioned Heritage Foundation, which has always been the bedrock for conservatisms. Even when conservatives were not in control of the White House, that's where a lot of conservatives went to wait to see if, in fact, there would be another Republican administration. But another think tank that has always been a breeding ground for conservative or free-thinking thought, especially as it relates to foreign policy, is the Cato Institute, which, as you may know, Farai, and PJ may know this as well, that's where Vice President Cheney was prior to him becoming vice president. That's where his wife still is. And so that's where a lot of the arch conservatives, or rather the hawks, come out of, just in terms of more of the conservative thought when it comes to transitioning to the White House. But to get to back to another point, Farai, just very, very quickly, because I know we're short on time. You know, the administrations come and go, but the bureaucracy always stays the same to a certain degree. We have 8 million bureaucrats that literally run the federal government on a day-to-day basis. And what we've seen with cabinet secretaries coming and going and with some vacancies, that the bureaucracy can run itself at least in the short term. So in both administrations, whether it be the Obama administration or the McCain administration, know that. So they have a little bit of time, but literally and figuratively, the planning has been going on now, probably right before the conventions.
When you take a look, there was something that the McCain campaign said that that Senator Obama was, quote, measuring the drapes in the Oval Office. Robert, do you think that there is a sense that the Obama campaign has gone too far in sort of laying out, okay, well, you know, we're ready to take the reins and here are some of the people whose names were floating? The McCain campaign has been more reticent, for good or bad?
That's the thinking. I mean, that's the thinking among some reporters in the chattering class off the record, is that, you know, we saw this a couple of months ago with the unveiling of the quote-unquote presidential seal, which the Obama campaign very quickly took down because that in itself looked very presidential. There was some chattering class among reporters, even among some McCain folks, about Obama's campaign plane, which had some remnants of Air Force One just in terms of its size, as well as how the paint scheme looked. And so the McCain campaign very quickly said, you know, this is why we should not have an Obama presidency. One of the main reasons why is because they are literally measuring the drapes. And the McCain campaign has been very, very cognizant of being very humble and saying, look, if we're fortunate enough to serve in the White House, and if, in fact, we do serve in the White House, the way they use their words is much, much different from the Obama candidacy, which says when I'm president or when we get to the White House. So there's a very different rhetorical stance there, but also from a symbolic stance, which one can make the argument works in both campaigns' favor.
PJ, I want to get through a couple more topics quickly. One of them is bipartisanship. When you're talking about not a transition team, but the team that the transition team puts in place, i.e. the first team of the new presidency, is there room for bipartisanship after such a tough campaign?
Well, I certainly hope so. You know, neither side has a monopoly on good ideas, although perhaps one side tries to suggest that, particularly when it comes to national security policy. I think bipartisanship will be very, very important. It will be very difficult in this kind of political climate. But back to a point that Robert was making, I think that it's you know, I mean, 77 days is not a lot of time. So the fact is that now
you mean the time between
November 4 and January 20. So I think at this point in time, I certainly hope that both the McCain campaigns and the Obama campaigns, they are setting up their core of transition leaders. They are vetting those names with the FBI. So very rapidly, almost literally, beginning on November 5, you can start to have some interaction between, you know, the winning camp, the Bush administration. I mean, in 2000, for example, I was in the White House as the Bush team was coming in. It was a very, very difficult environment, first because it was a very compressed transition period. But clearly there was a kind of a failure to communicate, if you will, perhaps, you know, clashing ideologies, and you know, that had an impact. So I certainly hope that the winning side will listen attentively to what the Bush administration wants to tell it. That's not to say that it will dictate, you know, policies going forward, but then starting on January 20, you want to have your cabinet secretaries confirmed in place, and then very rapidly after that start to fill out the essential cadre of civilian leaders who will, as Robert said, begin to guide that bureaucracy, whether it's at the Pentagon, for example, at Homeland Security, at HHS. And so I think we have to get to a situation where this becomes more part of the campaign and is not seen as being presumptuous.
All right, Robert. To you for one final question. We have seen Senator Obama talking quite a bit with the former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker. Some people are saying that there should be a holdover of Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson because we're in such a, you know, a period of flux. Why switch horses in midstream? Do you think that's a possibility? Does he want it? Does either campaign want it?
I think Secretary Paulson would be open to the idea, given the magnitude of the situation that we're in. You know, that's really up to that's the president's or the president-elect's pleasure. You know, that's really up to him. You know, let's put it this way. If Senator Obama was to be elected president, I think intellectually he would probably listen to Secretary Paulson, albeit whether it be in an advisory role or a voluntary role, or perhaps maybe even on as Secretary of the Treasury for, you know, a short period of time. But the president has the right, or the president-elect has the right to pick his or her own people. If it's Senator McCain, I would suspect that he probably would very quickly get rid of all of President Bush's advisors, given the fact that he's been labeled of voting with President Bush 90% of the time. So I think perceptionally, President McCain would very, very quickly get rid of Bush's staffers.
All right, gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.
Farai, thank you very much.
We were speaking with Robert Trainum, the D.C. Bureau Chief for the Comcast Cable Network CNA, and P.J. Crowley, Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. A former president of Botswana wins the 2008 Ibrahim Prize for Achievement in African Leadership, and another aid worker is murdered in East Africa, just one of several. For more on this week's Africa Update, we've got Bill Fletcher. He's a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and former president of TransAfrica Forum. Hi, Bill.
I'm really glad to be here. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, but sad news from Somalia. There was an engineer working for the UN shot to death yesterday, and 2 days earlier, another UN aid worker was murdered. These are just the latest in a series of assassination-style killings of aid workers in Somalia. And the UN says 28 aid workers have been killed in the country in the last year. We've got a little bit of John Holmes, the UN Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, on the growing dangers faced by aid workers.
These are people being targeted deliberately because they are humanitarian workers, and that is frankly outrageous and unacceptable. On the part of some people, at least, there is a sort of ideological perception that any intervention from the outside, including by NGOs just as much as UN agencies, is somehow perceived as interfering with the sovereignty or part of some Western agenda. Frankly, this is just a misperception. We have nothing to do with any political or security agendas of anybody else. These are people really devoting their lives to helping others, and the fact that they are then targeted and killed and abducted is an outrage which I don't think we denounce enough, frankly.
He says we don't denounce it enough. What do you think about the attention that is being paid or isn't being paid to the risks that aid workers are taking in Somalia and, you know, throughout the world?
Well, in general, I think that we take the whole issue of aid workers entirely without any seriousness, that there are reports, you know, such and such is killed today and it's too bad, and then we move on. So I think that most of the public have no sense of the dangers that these unarmed individuals and very courageous individuals are taking when they engage in humanitarian activity.
Now, these are not just, you know, accidental killings or killings in the line of a greater fire. These are targeted killings. Is that something different from what we've seen before in different conflicts, or have there been patterns of targeted killings of aid workers in other conflicts?
Over time, the killing of civilians, I think, has increased, and that includes aid workers. What's happening in Somalia is somewhat complicated. A lot of the aid workers that are being killed are Somalis themselves. And part of the issue is that the aid workers are in many cases identified with the Ethiopian occupation forces. I'm not saying that they're representing, but that they are identified that way, and therefore it's open season. And so in listening to that clip, I think it is very important that there's a real clarification of who the aid workers are serving. But I think, Farai, that the other issue is that keep in mind that Somalia is in the midst of a combination of a guerrilla war, an occupation, and a gang fight. And so we don't have two sides. We have multiple sides here. And some of the armed forces, including some of the armed Islamist forces, are actually out of control. And they are no longer under the political leadership of the of civilian forces. So that is what makes the situation so incredibly dangerous.
I want to move on to another topic, and it's definitely one that has a much more hopeful edge to it. We're talking about Botswana's former president, Festus Mohai, the latest African leader to be awarded the Ibrahim Prize for Good Governance in Africa. Now, Mo Ibrahim is a Sudanese telecom entrepreneur. He has given away $5 million distributed over 10 years, followed by $200,000 a year in a pension for life to African leaders who essentially do a good job and then leave. Which has always been an issue. Former UN head Kofi Annan described the purpose of the prize.
It aims to identify those leaders who often, against considerable odds, have made a real difference in the lives of their people and their countries. Through this prize, the Foundation's objective is to recognize and celebrate achievement in leadership. In so doing, the Foundation tells a story about Africa that is too rarely told. By recognizing achievement and telling Africa's story, I think the Foundation is making a unique contribution, a valuable contribution to the development of our continent.
So what makes the former Botswanan president someone who is lauded?
Well, there's what makes Mogai himself the recipient of this prize, which was just identified in terms of being prepared to step down. But there's also that Botswana has been identified as being the least corrupt African country with the greatest level of political stability. And so I think that what's important here, the good news, is that this is an example that should be emulated. And in fact, hopefully will be written into constitutions of countries, of more countries in Africa, of term limits. And here was a leader who stepped down and did not have to be carried out one way or the other. Botswana itself is a very complicated story, though. And in that, while it is stable, its wealth is largely based on extractive industries. And so one of the real concerns is that in order for Botswana to really increase its growth, it's going to have to diversify its economy.
And when you say extractive industries, you mean mining.
Mining, right, right. The good news here is that as opposed to places like Nigeria, where the principal extractive industry, that is oil, has resulted in an immense amount of corruption, in Botswana that's not been the case. So that's the good news. The downside, though, is that a country that's overly reliant on extractive industries faces a problem when those minerals start to run out. And so you have an insufficient diversification of the country over the long haul.
Just quickly, the former president of Mozambique won the inaugural prize last year. Do we have any idea how he's spending the money? I mean, is it just basically at your personal will that you can choose what to spend the money on, including yourself?
Well, I don't know whether former President Chissano is spending the money in this way, but I do know that over the last several years, he has been working to develop a non-governmental organization or project that focuses on the rebuilding of villages in Mozambique, including everything from basic infrastructure, water wells, things along those lines.
Well,
and
thanks.
Remember, the country was devastated by a war that the apartheid regime in South Africa prosecuted.
Well, Bill, great to talk to you. Thank you.
Always. Thank you very much.
Bill Fletcher is a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and the former president of TransAfrica Forum, and he's co-author of Solidarity Divided, The Crisis in Organized Labor and a New Path Towards Social Justice. He joined us from our Washington headquarters. The path of the AIDS pandemic has changed over time. Now one of the key groups of people with HIV are African women. The Elizabeth Glazer Pediatric AIDS Foundation has been around for 20 years, and its work in Africa has grown. Today, the foundation supports more than 3,000 clinics in 17 countries, mostly in sub-Saharan Africa. Pam Barnes is the organization's president and CEO. She recently went to Kenya and South Africa with actress Gloria Rubin, a celebrity ambassador for the group. They came to visit us at NPR West, and I started by asking Pam to describe the history of the foundation and its mission.
Elizabeth Glazer contracted HIV through a blood transfusion after the birth of her daughter, Arielle, and unknowingly contracted the disease and subsequently passed along the virus to Arielle and then to her son, born a few years later. And it wasn't until Arielle was 7 years old and got sick, took a long time to diagnose, and then the family realized that she had HIV, and so the rest of the family was tested, found that Elizabeth was positive, as well as her son, Jake. Paul Glazer, the father, was not positive. Arielle died, and then subsequently Elizabeth, with two friends, Susan De Laurentiis and Susie Zegan, created the foundation really to be sure that children were kept in the forefront. In those days, certainly in the early 1990s, the focus at that time in the United States was on the gay community and the spread of the disease, and children were barely an afterthought. Elizabeth created the foundation, and when she died in 1994, many of us have been able to keep that legacy alive by continuing to work with children.
Gloria, why did you choose this organization? Of all the organizations you could have chosen to work with, why this one?
You know, when I was first on ER, and when the storyline that I did at that time through Jeannie Boulay, who was an HIV-positive physician assistant, I, as is often the case with people that are on television shows, you get invited to support numerous foundations. And that was when I was first introduced to the Elizabeth Glazer Pediatric AIDS Foundation. I've been an activist on the issue of HIV/AIDS for quite a few years now. But it was earlier this year in New York when Pam and I had met each other at an event that the foundation was having, and we immediately clicked. And from that moment, we had talked about, you know, South Africa and about the possibility of a pending trip. And then a short while after that, they so generously asked if I would like to, you know, be an ambassador for the foundation. And of course, you know, how could I say no? It's really an honor to be associated with the foundation.
So you recently visited Kenya and South Africa. I'm going to ask each of you what stayed in your heart from that trip.
I was in both Kenya and South Africa, one of the 8 to 9 trips that I make a year to Africa. And a wonderful question you just asked, and I had an immediate visual, what stayed with me. So consider that I go quite often, and I must tell you, I always have those moments that stay with me, no matter the country, no matter how many times I go. And in this particular trip with Gloria, we were in a hospital in South Africa. And as we were standing in one of the lobbies, one of the midwives came out and was so excited. We'd met her earlier in the day, and she said, "You must come back into labor and delivery. One of the moms from the Prevention of Mother-to-Child Transmission Program has had a baby, and the mom is very excited, and the baby is negative, and mom is sitting up, and she'd love to see you." And so Gloria and I went back in, and I must tell you, the joy on the part of the midwives who were there, as well as the mom, will always be with me.
That's amazing.
I was going to choose that very same story.
Yeah.
It's so true what Pam just said, the joy on her face. It was truly, truly inspiring. And I know that that word is used a lot, but this really was very much so.
What about the coordination between a foundation like this one and government? Because there is the PEPFAR program. And do you work with government programs that are trying to put this into action as well?
We work with governments in each one of the countries. In fact, we only work in a country where we're invited to work there by the Ministry of Health. And again, I think Gloria saw that with us on the visit. I'll let Gloria speak to that. But we don't create new clinics and new hospitals. We work in the ministry hospitals. And we train those midwives, our midwives who are there employed by the Ministry of Health. It's the backbone of the existing system, and what we're trying to do is to train, enhance, and build the capacity to be able to deliver these services.
And that kind of work being done, particularly in a country like South Africa, you know, when Mbeki was in, which is, you know, we'll see how the new leadership handles it, but being able to do that kind of work with the challenges that that particular administration had in terms of even acknowledging that HIV causes AIDS, you know, says a lot that the foundation was invited in and that this kind of work is happening there.
What do you think about the issue of women's empowerment as a part of ending the transmission of AIDS? Did you get a chance to ever talk to any women about whether or not they felt like they could make
Yes.
independent sexual choices?
Well, I tell you, the first segment of my trip to South Africa was with Carrie Kennedy and her human rights work. And I believe that both are very much intertwined, the human rights and the HIV/AIDS pandemic in any country. And a big part of that issue is because of the gender inequality and because of the disempowerment that women feel. There's just kind of a powerlessness that, that women have over their own lives sexually. And there's also this element, poverty plays a huge key, because when there is no hope for any kind of job or any kind of future, there's this mentality of a communal mentality sometimes of, well, this gives me meaning in my life. Well, what else would I do other than have a child? It can sometimes be a part of that, you know, hopelessness that can be in communities where poverty is rampant. So, you know,
like in the U.S.
Well, mm-hmm. bingo. Mm-hmm. Totally. There's a reason why it's still a pandemic, why it's very much a pandemic in the African American and Latino communities here in the United States. Are those two things combined for sure, gender inequality and poverty and hopelessness?
I think I'd add to that, Gloria, the issue of stigma. Often we're asked what may be significant barriers to being able to treat women or to make sure that we can offer services to as many women as possible, and stigma is certainly a part of that.
Gloria, I want to ask you about celebrity, because one of the things that's really come into the public discourse in the past few years is how celebrity can be leveraged for major social issues. Do you feel that your celebrity is a force for good?
I think that if people know your face, then choose something that matters to you and be out there and be a spokesperson for that issue. That's what I think. I mean, it's such kind of a frivolous, kind of silly thing in a way to be an actor. I mean, in some ways it really is. And so this, frankly, doing this kind of work adds a lot of substance to that.
Pam, before we let you go, if you could have a magic wand, and I will occasionally resort to my magic wand question, and just deal with one aspect of the work that you do and fix it forever, what would that be?
For Rye, it would be that every child is born without HIV. It's possible. We can do it. We've done it elsewhere in the world. So the magic wand may have some power. We just need to be able to keep it working.
Pam and Gloria, thank you.
Thank you.
Pam Barnes is president and CEO of the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation, and we've also been speaking with actress Gloria Rubin, who is a foundation ambassador. Both join me here at our NPR West studios, and you can watch video of this interview at our website, nprnewsandviews.org. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. In the waning days of the presidential election, Americans have learned a lot about our own racial attitudes, and sometimes we've learned about our history as well. Senator John McCain has a deep and specific tie to the history of the country's racial legacy. McCain's ancestors owned a Mississippi plantation and about 120 slaves who worked on the grounds. Douglas Blackman is the Atlanta bureau chief for the Wall Street Journal, and he tracked down some of the descendants of the McCain plantation. He just wrote the article, Two Families Named McCain. We're also joined today by one of those family members, Lily McCain. She's a professor of psychology at Mott Community College in Flint, Michigan. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you very
much. Thanks for having me.
So let me start with you, Douglas. Why did you decide to research the McCain genealogy, and then how did you do it?
Well, I had a book that came out earlier this year called Slavery by Another Name that was about this sort of terrible history in our past of how African Americans were forced back into a kind of slavery after the Civil War and deep into the 20th century. And one of the readers of that book emailed me a couple of months ago and suggested that I might find it interesting to look into the history of the McCain family. And what really intrigued me, though, was not that the McCains had once owned slaves, but the idea that if there were descendants of those slaves who I could find today, how would they see this extraordinarily historic moment in our life as a society in which we have this person connected to their past in such an intimate way running for president against the first African-American nominee.
And how'd you find Lily McCain?
I went over to Mississippi, to Carroll County, where she has siblings who are still living there, one of them on the family property that's been in the family for a couple of generations now, and spent some time looking through census records and asking around, and finally, you know, found my way to her sister, Mary McCain Fluker. From there, I had the good fortune to get to meet all of Lily McCain's living siblings, who are a truly remarkable group of Americans and really demonstrate fascinating things about how much our society has changed in the last 100 years.
So what was it like when he first contacted you?
I was surprised that he'd contacted us. It just happened that we were on our way to Mississippi to surprise our brother for his 60th birthday. And my sister informed us that Douglas would meet us at her home. We were delighted to share with him and found it intriguing that he was interested in the story.
Tell me a little bit about your family's path from the time that members of your family were enslaved on this plantation to being not only free people, but obviously you yourself being a, you know, a PhD holding professional. Give me just a couple of people who were part of that chain.
Actually, it goes back as far as my paternal grandfather, who owned 40 acres of land. When my father returned from World War II, he purchased 120 acres of land and split it with his cousin. And we grew up then on a 60-acre farm right there at Teoc, Mississippi. Teoc, as I understand it, used to be the McCain Plantation, and therefore McCain was just a prominent name in that area. It felt as if we were related to everybody in the community.
There was no particular secret that your McCains were descended from the relatives of Senator McCain. Did you ever think?
Absolutely not. We were told of that from childhood.
Did you bring it up yourself during the election? Like go around being like, hey, you know what? You know, Senator McCain, you know, he's connected to our family.
No, I didn't. There was an oral history program put together at Mott some time ago. We started, the program was related to the civil rights era. I participated in an interview related. And during that interview, I wandered on to the years of my childhood at Teoc, Mississippi, and eventually found myself talking about the McCain connection. And they were interested in that at Mott College. From that point, I really have not talked about it frequently, although it's not something that I'm ashamed of. I've just not talked about it frequently.
Doug, in your article, you quote a statement from Senator McCain that says, "How the Teoc descendants have served their community and by extension their country is a testament to the power of family, love, compassion, and the human spirit." How do you personally, Doug, relate to that statement?
Well, the Black McCains, I just can't say enough about what a remarkable group of people they are. Not just Lily McCain and her siblings, but all the way back to the slave whose name was Isom McCain and his wife, Letty McCain, who married sometime right after the Civil War or around the end of the Civil War. But every generation of the Black McCains, from the very beginning after emancipation, this was a family that was intent on their own self-improvement and on the self-improvement of the community they lived in. Lily's great-grandfather was involved in starting what must have been the very first school for African Americans in this incredibly impoverished community in the 1880s. Her grandfather, as she told you, bought land and was a man who encouraged other African Americans to obtain property and build their own economic independence. And then her father led voter registration drives in the 1960s. He worked with Stokely Carmichael when Stokely came to Greenwood, Mississippi and Carroll County. Lily and some of her siblings were arrested in a march in Jackson, Mississippi. They integrated the public schools. Their church was burned down by the Ku Klux Klan after Stokely Carmichael spoke there. Lily's sister, Mary, ended up as a teacher, spending her career as a teacher in the public schools of Carroll County that none of the McCain children were allowed to attend until they integrated those schools.
Lily, what's your family like? And what I mean by that is obviously you have a long and proud history of being part of the fabric of American self-improvement. What do you like in terms of getting together? I mean, would we find a bunch of the McCains sitting around a table talking about politics, or do you guys get together for family reunions and talk about your family stories?
We are a very closely knitted family. I have not, to date, spent a Christmas away from home. And when I say home, I'm talking Tioch, Mississippi. Our parents left the 60 acres to us. The home house is still active. We go there. We get together. We love to eat and talk. We absolutely love each other. We have great respect for what each individual has contributed. We support each other in everything that we do.
Have you talked about this presidential election and who you among your family are going to vote for?
I'm very pleased to tell you that I'm going to support Barack Obama, and it's a pleasure to do that. I'm fairly sure that all of my siblings are supporting Barack Obama, not because he is a black man, but because of his intelligence, because we believe that he is the man for the job.
Douglas, what kind of reaction have you gotten to the article?
It has spanned the gamut of everything you might imagine. I have gotten hundreds of emails and other comments over the last 3 days, and many readers read the story exactly in the way that I hoped it would be read, as a triumphal story, really, of two families, of how the black McCains overcame the legacy of slavery, but also how the white McCains broke from that very dark past and created a new tradition of national service and military service. I've also gotten an enormous number of emails from people who interpreted the story to be some sort of an attempt to smear John McCain, which, of course, it's not, because the fact that his great-great-grandfather owned slaves speaks nothing about who John McCain is today. I do think it's impressive that after all of this time, that the McCain reunion at Tioch Plantation that happens every 2 years has African Americans and whites, and that whether they agree on their biological connections or not, that they have a shared respect for one another.
Lily, before I let you go, do you get a sense just from, you know, being a teacher, for example, at Mott Community College, that people who may not have been invested in the past, in voting and civics are engaged?
Yes, I do. My impression is that we have far more young people involved than we have had before. And I attribute much of that to the energy of Barack Obama's campaign. I think the idea that particularly African American young people are able to see hope in that America has come to the point where they're willing to give Barack Obama a chance, not because of the color of his skin, but again, as Dr. King said, because of the content of his character. I'm just so elated that America has grown so much in such a short period of time. Douglas was able to reveal that I'm only 5 generations from slavery. When I think about that, I am just amazed at the growth of this country.
Lily, Doug, thank you.
You're so welcome.
Lily McCain is a professor of psychology at Mott Community College in Flint, Michigan. She joined us from the studios of Radio Broadcast Services in Royal Oak, Michigan. And Douglas Blackman is the Atlanta Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal. He just wrote the article, Two Families Named McCain. Candidates' kin share a history with descendants of slaves. He's also the author of Slavery by Another Name, and he joined us from the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting in Atlanta. He was known as Dolomite and Willie Green. I'm talking about the rhyming comedian Rudy Ray Moore. Moore died over the weekend after a long battle with illness. He was 81 years old. He cut countless blue comedy records beginning in 1959. He also made several cult films during the blaxploitation era. Here to help us put Moore's career in perspective is Todd Boyd. He's a professor of critical studies at the University of Southern California's School of Cinematic Arts. Hi, Todd.
Hi.
So, to give us a taste of Rudy Ray Moore, let's listen to a trailer from his first film, the self-produced Dolomite, circa 1974.
Dolomite is my name, and f***ing up mother is my game. I've got an all-girl army that knows what to do. They'll box as hell and practice kung fu. I put my finger in the ground and turn the whole world around. Yes, I'm Dolomite. I'm the one that killed Monday and whooped Tuesday and put Wednesday in the hospital. Called up Thursday to tell Friday not to bury Saturday on Sunday. I'm the one that had the elephants roosting in trees and all the ants wearing BVD. From the first to the last, I give them the blast so fast that their life is passed before their ass has even hit the grass. See me uptown, downtown, crowned and renowned. Delayed, relayed, mislaid, and parlayed. Hatch, match, snatch, and scratch. Whack, jack, smack, crack, bootblack, blackjack, racetrack, and flapjack, and still coming back. If you crave satisfaction, this is the place to find that action. Coming to this theater as this next attraction is the picture that will put you in traction. Dolomite.
Okay, Todd. That's a lot of information to process, and it's dated, you know. What is it saying, or where is it in the history of kind of popular black cinema? What are we supposed to make out of this?
Well, the importance of a figure like Rudy Ray Moore and the Dolomite character comes from the fact that it represented what some might refer to as the Chitlin circuit of, say, black popular culture from another era. A time when there were still elements of black culture that were only, you know, performed for black audiences. A time before, you know, the time we live in now, where elements of black culture are pretty pervasive across the landscape and are very accessible in the mainstream. In Rudy Ray Moore's time and his era, that was just starting to happen. But Rudy Ray Moore was someone who had a loyal black fan base who spoke to his audiences about issues that would be funny to them and in a manner and in a language that was very familiar. But I think that element of black culture, what some might call black folk culture, has probably passed at this point, but his significance lies in the fact that he, in many ways, transcended that moment because he was, of course, later referenced many, many times as hip-hop culture became so prominent.
Tell us about some of those references. I mean, you know, you can definitely listen to Snoop and hear him reference Dolomite. Why would hip-hop artists reference this character?
Well, again, you know, Dolomite is a figure from an era of black popular culture that was, at least in his case, segregated. And so if you were a young black male, growing up in the, you know, 60s and 70s, learning the Dolomite routines was like a rite of passage. And so for a generation of rappers coming of age in the 80s, they would have listened to Dolomite, they would have been exposed to Dolomite, and you have, you know, people like Too Short, what he calls his favorite word, this exaggerated pronunciation of the word that people would be very familiar with if they know Too Short, actually grows from Rudy Ray Moore. You could talk about Big Daddy Kane versus Dolomite on a Big Daddy Kane record, Taste of Chocolate, in which the two of them sort of went at each other in this verbal joust reminiscent of the cutting sessions that defined the black oral tradition. So as hip-hop started to come of age, you have other examples like Dr. Dre on The Chronic, for instance. He uses a sample of Dolomite's joke, "If I Had Some Nuts Hanging on the Wall." So, you know, if you knew that culture, if you learned it as a rite of passage, and then later on started to come of age as hip-hop became popular, to use Dolomite was to indicate your connection to that older era, but at the same time make him relevant in a more contemporary environment.
His contemporaries included people like Red Fox and Richard Pryor. Why do you think he wasn't more popular in the mainstream?
Well, you know, Red Fox and his stand-up comedy was actually part of a similar circuit as that of Dolomite. But at a certain point, Red Fox transcended that and, of course, became quite popular on Sanford and Son. But if you look at Red Fox on Sanford and Son and you listen to his stand-up routines, they're two different things. Richard Pryor, you know, the greatest American comedian ever, if you know his career, he started out as someone imitating Bill Cosby in the early 60s, and it wasn't until the late 60s that he evolved. He hooked up with Huey Newton and the Black Panther Party, developed a great deal of consciousness, and that material, came to define his presence in the 70s with his stand-up comedy. In the case of Rudy Ray Moore, it's folk culture. It's what some would call country. It's not necessarily something that's going to appeal to a broad audience, but would appeal to those who are familiar with those customs.
All right. Professor, thank you.
Thank you.
Todd Boyd is the Catherine and Frank Price Endowed Chair for the Study of Race and Popular Culture. He's also a professor of critical studies at the University of Southern California School of Cinematic Arts. And that's our show for today. Thank you for sharing your time with us. To listen to the show or subscribe to our podcast, visit our website, nprnewsandnotes.org.